Chef Daniel Patterson is one of the most thoughtful chefs in the business, and he's taking his cooking into a realm that could be our food of the future, but probably without the white tablecloths. At his Michelin two-starred restaurant, Qua, in San Francisco, you're going to eat like a king. 8 courses, seemingly simple, but full of surprises. For instance, a bowl of grits that's really buttered popcorn, a tomato salad with olive oil but not drizzled. Instead, it's frozen into a scoop of gelato. Yeah, it's vegetable-centric, but it's not vegetarian. Well, commentator Francis Lamb talked with Daniel Patterson.
So hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Daniel, the first time I came to Qua and sat down and had the tasting menu, I was so blown away by the simplicity of it and how clear the flavors were and how surprising the textures were. I remember this really wonderful beet snow with rose and this upside-down tomato tart with these super intense little tomatoes. And, you know, I was so sad when it was over. But I also remember realizing that, wow, after 11 courses, I was counting, and there were only 2 that had any kind of meat or fish. Are you weaning your guests towards vegetarianism?
I'm hopefully not weaning them towards anything except delicious food. You know, I'm not vegetarian. I love cooking with vegetables, but, you know, there's kind of a crossover between what I like personally and what we serve in the restaurant, but it's not 100% one for one. So I don't go in with any kind of agenda except to make people happy. That's my agenda. You know, now, for example, we have California sturgeon caviar, which is a protein, you know. Mm-hmm. It comes from an animal. It's actually a pretty extraordinary product now. It's just gotten better and better. We've got gooey duck, which is a giant clam native to Washington, native to the West Coast. And we have lamb and crab, Dungeness crab, which is one of our best local products. So what is that? 4 things. Mm-hmm. But just a little bit of everything. But everything is there for a purpose, I guess.
But let's talk about the focus on vegetables. What do you enjoy about cooking with them? It seems like you're really inspired by them.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, I've tried to think about where did this come from? You know, I didn't necessarily grow up with it and I didn't learn it anywhere. When we talk about vegetables, we're talking about plants. And the whole plant kingdom is so vast. So we work with wild plants. And wild plants, it's like wild sage. There's 100 kinds of wild sage, and the same variety in 2 different places is going to taste totally different. It's like being a painter and someone gives you 100 new colors that no one's ever seen before or no one usually works with. Your ability to create something kind of fresh and new and to kind of look at the world in a new way is vastly increased. Mm. So what it does is it's like if you think about cooking as a language, vegetables give you a lot more vocabulary than if you're just cooking with meat. Because the fact is that different varieties of meat are going to taste much more similar than different varieties of a particular kind of herb or vegetable.
Yeah. Can you think of a dish that you've served that really makes you think, wow, that really shows something new about this plant?
You know, what I hope is that, you know, every dish shows a little something. So it's like, I guess one of the things that we try and do is combine familiar and strange in a way that, so familiarity is connection to culture, connection to tradition. I mean, food is about people, so we want to keep that connection to other people. You know, I'm just one speck on a long continuum of cooks over thousands of years, and I want to keep that connection there because that's where the emotional power is. But something new that you haven't seen before, well, that's like the shock of, you know, like excitement, you know, when you combine the two, and it's a very powerful kind of paradigm. So, you know, for example, the beet dish that you mentioned, the beets basically made to look like a rose, cut in such a way, very labor intensive, a little bit of aerated yogurt and rose petal ice. Mm-hmm. And the rose petal ice is just made like a tea. It's only 5 ingredients. And something that I personally love is the challenge of making something with something really humble and making it as exciting as if the customer was getting something really foreign or kind of a traditional luxury ingredient. So to make, I mean, let's be honest, to make a beet as exciting as, you know, caviar or foie gras is, you know, it's got to be a pretty damn good beet.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the amount of creativity and imagination that goes into it, you know, when you're creating kind of a little bit of a limitation, I think limitations kind of force creativity.
Yeah.
So for me, What I would hope is, like, I've just eaten a beet that tastes intensely of beet, and yet the form is different, and what it's surrounded with is different, and the temperature and texture is not what I was expecting. So I get what I thought I was going to get, and then something a little bit more, too.
Yeah. But, you know, there's this idea of limitation that you've brought up. At the same time, you're also saying, well, one of the reasons why you love working with vegetables is because they add so many colors to your palate. In a sense, they relieve you of limitations or sort of a sense of what a limitation might be. At the same time, you also say you wouldn't want to be a vegetarian, that there's something about animal food, there's something about meat and fish that satisfies you in a way that just plants usually don't. What do you love about those foods?
It's a much bigger conversation around vegetarianism versus omnivorousness, let's just say.
No, I just mean from a culinary point of view. Just from a deliciousness point of view.
Yeah, no, but I mean, even if you're talking from a deliciousness point of view, because then you're getting into the physiology of how your body responds to animal fats, which is very well. So the perception of deliciousness of, for example, we have on the menu right now, lamb that's poached in oil that's a little bit kind of tinged with rosemary, and then it's at a low temperature, and then it's grilled over charcoal to finish it. And the smell of that is just like mouthwatering. And it satisfies a certain kind of craving in a different sort of way. I feel like I could replace that, but the fact is I don't cook in a vacuum. And I'm not cooking for some abstraction of what I think is a perfect meal. Right. I'm cooking for customers, my customers. And we've kind of tried a lot of things over the years. And I've learned what my customers like and don't like, how far I can go, and what's really important. What I've learned is that it makes them happy to have that primal sort of piece of meat, really well cooked, well cared for, like well raised, delicious. But if there's one moment of that in the meal, it's enough. And there's one thing to bend people's expectation. It's another thing to break it entirely past a point at which they become disappointed. Because restaurants and cooking, it's all expectation fulfillment. And the thing, the bedrock, the most important thing at Qua that we feel, we're cooking for people. We're not cooking for ourselves. And they would be disappointed if we did not have at least that one moment of a perfectly cooked, aromatic, just juicy and kind of almost that primal experience kind of piece of meat at one point in the meal.
Yeah.
And so that anchors in a sense and allows us to do what we want for the rest of the meal. And it gives us a lot of leeway.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great to be on.
Chef Daniel Patterson has the Michelin 2-starred restaurant Qua in San Francisco. Food writer Francis Lam is also editor-at-large for Clarkson Potter. Now, Daniel left us with a recipe for beets with bergamot, mint, and wildflowers. And you know where to find it, splendidtable.org.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.